Welcome back to the Jewish Futurism Lab, where we unpack Torah, tech, and tomorrow. I'm Mike Wirth, Jewish futurist, community artist, and design educator, coming to you from Crown Town, Charlotte, North Carolina. Today we're going to climb into the paper time machine of a Jewish tinkerer named Hugo Gernsback, the inventor-publisher who helped teach a generation how to think about the future before science fiction was even a genre. We'll look at how his pulpy magazines, wild cover art, and hobbyist gadgets turn immigrant kids and radio nerds into amateur futurists, and how all this sits inside a much bigger Jewish story. Let's get into it, y'all. So Hugo Gernsback is born Hugo Gernsbacher in Luxembourg in 1884. Luxembourg's a tiny little country in Europe. Into a Jewish family that will eventually send him across the Atlantic. He lands in the United States in 1904, not as a writer, but as a tinkerer, an importer of radio parts, obsessed with wireless, long before most people had ever heard a broadcast. He founds the Electro Importing Company. He ships coils and condensers to hobbyists across the country, then does something quite revolutionary. He starts publishing magazines to teach his customers how to use this strange equipment. In Gernsback's world, media and machines always come as a pair, early examples of parametric design. His early magazines mix how-to diagrams with speculative essays and eventually fiction. Shortly into the first few issues of his magazine, he coins the term in which he combines scientific and fiction by the fic, and it's scientifiction. I know. Stories that are grounded in real science that extrapolate honesty from what we know and that carries a didactic mission. You should walk away not just entertained, but feeling upgraded, a little bit more future literate than you were before. Gernsback is a Jewish immigrant operating at the edge of respectability, frankly, in a United States that is deeply anti-Semitic and suspicious of outsiders at the time. Traditional cultural institutions are mostly closed to people like him, but there is room in this liminal in-between space of technical hobbies and pulp magazine paper. For someone who can think like an engineer and hustle like a small-time publisher. When I talk about Hugo Gernsback, I'm not just talking about a researcher. I'm talking as a kid who grew up building futures on my living room floor. I had Legos, and if you were a kid of the 80s and Gen X, you had Constructs, Lincoln Logs, Tinker Toys, Kinder Blocks, Brio trains spread out everywhere, and just, you know, networks of different things connecting across and under my coffee table. I glued together testers' model airplanes. I packed wadding into Estes rockets and watched them arc over my neighborhood. Later, it was RC model cars, hobbyist circuit kits from Radio Shack, if you're old enough to remember that, God bless you, and eventually opening up my own computer to swap out hard drives, RAM, video cards, and sound cards back in the day. I love to tinker. And before the web, my internet were my catalogs. I would feverishly read them page by page, like sacred texts of possibility, just every part. Like, whoa, what does that do? Radio Shack, Edmund Scientific, hobby shops, computer mail order lists. For a lot of Gen X kids and more than a few older millennials, those catalogs were our pipeline to the things that we really cared about, right? Like you would find online today. And that was how you discovered gear and products and equipment and imagined projects and, you know, planned out your next build. You know, what was it that you're going to make from this? It was just all possible. So when I look at Gernsback's magazines, as old as they are, right? I was definitely not old enough to read these. I see a very familiar ecosystem. He was doing for his generation, right? 100 some odd years ago, what those catalogs and kits did for mine, offering blueprints, part lists, and daydreams, a place where you could see the future laid out in diagrams and ads and stories, and then try to assemble your own version of it on your kitchen table, right? Again, great parametric design. So in 1926, Gernsback launches his probably most famous magazine, Amazing Stories, the first magazine devoted entirely to what we now call science fiction. And I remember in the 80s, I think it was Steven Spielberg who had come out with the Amazing Stories series, which was a television show that had like very intense fantasy science fiction like stories, very much like The Outer Limits and The Twilight Zone. So back to Gernsback here and his magazine, Amazing Stories, 1926. You know, on its surface, it just kind of looks like another one that's come onto the racks. You know, Gernsback had actually put out several magazines, and there were others competing as well. But it had like really garish covers and like some wild titles. And, you know, it was a mix of some old stuff that he had reprinted and a little bit of new work. But to, you know, a kid back then picking it up off the drugstore rack, I mean, it is a portal to another dimension. Amazing Stories tells you, right, implicitly that you are allowed to think in futures, right? It's like escape this world. Think you can think about moral questions, but now we're in the, you know, Alpha Centauri, right, system. What's happening there? What are the rules there that allow us to examine our own lives, but now in this future setting? The rules in these magazines are deceptively simple. You take one scientific idea that exists today and you push it forward, right? Show the social, the ethical, and the personal impacts and consequences of something, right? So like take what we're dealing with today and then, you know, push it into the future. You could see how feeling about AI over the last century having that doomsday scenario, right? You know, the Terminator, HAL 9000, you know, Oort from the day the earth stood still, you know, just these like killer mindless AI death machines, right? You know, in these places, there's no studio budget to worry about, no special effects department, no nervous sponsor, right? On the page, a writer can build a world on monorails, rocket ships, telepathic radios for the price of a few thousand words. A teenager can walk into that world for a dime. That was the trade-off of these magazines. Pretty straightforward. Gernsback spells this out in his editorials. He wrote a lot of editorials at the end of the magazine. You know, we've seen Stan Lee do that over for many decades. Scientifiction, he says, should be charming romance intermingled with scientific fact and prophetic vision. The gadgets must make sense. The worlds must obey their own logic. The reader should feel on some level that this could really happen. What he is quietly doing is teaching now a generation of readers and writers to prototype the future in narrative form, that the future is a story space, right? It's where you can, you know, build anything, where anything is possible. The magazine becomes a lab bench without a ceiling. You know, there's nothing holding this in. And Gernsback's vision would not have landed as hard without a collaborator. And that's the illustrator Frank R. Paul. Paul, trained originally in architecture, becomes Gernsback's go-to visualizer of the future. He paints the cover of Ralph 124C41 Plus, Gernsback's own gadget stuff novel, and the first cover of Amazing Stories. His images are wild. Super tall, towering machines, just sprawling, super futuristic cities, bizarre alien landscapes, intricate robots, all rendered with an engineer's love of structure. You know, if Gernsback builds the system, the magazines, the fan culture, you know, the editorial rules, Paul is there to create the iconography. His covers teach readers what the future looks like, right? Chrome domes on top of buildings, struts, beams, cables, and enormous controls in panels. You know, later science fiction giants like Arthur C. Clarke wrote 2001, A Space Odyssey. Ray Bradbury wrote The Martian Chronicles. You know, we'll cite these covers as their first glimpse of science fiction as a visual universe. And, you know, Paul isn't Jewish. So, you know, we absorb him, we love him, right? Because he really is a part of the ecosystem that Gernsback is creating. And, you know, a hybrid of Jewish editorial vision and immigrant visual craft that standardizes the look and feel of technological future. So in many ways, Paul not being Jewish, Gernsbach being Jewish, isn't, we're always looking for through lenses to see how this makes sense, right? What influences may or may not have come through this. So this combination here is, Gernsbach and Paul both being immigrants, I think is an experience that they both understand. They both get that idea of being the outsider. So step back and let's look at the wider picture here for a second. So the early 20th century is a time of mass Jewish immigration, tightening quotas, and rising anti-Semitism in Europe and the United States. Conventional cultural power is locked up. Universities, established publishing houses, prestigious theaters, gates are closed everywhere. But on the fringes, there is new media forming. Pulp magazine, radio stations, comics, and experimental films. These industries are considered low prestige, risky, sometimes even disreputable, which makes them very accessible to Jewish and other immigrant and minority peoples at the time. Jewish artists, writers, and entrepreneurs carve out lives in these spaces. They invent superheroes in the comics. They craft noir in Hollywood. And in Gernsbach's case, they build a whole new genre where technology is not just the scenery, but the central driver of the plot. Later, explicitly Jewish science fiction will lean hard into these Jewish themes: diaspora, exile, covenant, golems, law, memory. Writers like Isaac Asimov, Carol M. Schwiller, Jack Dann, and anthologies like The Wandering Stars make the Jewishness visible. Gernsbach does something more infrastructural and, in a way, more subtle. He constructs the platform on which these stories can exist. He doesn't fill amazing stories with rabbis and midrash. Instead, he builds a space where questions that have long animated Jewish thought, responsibility, creation, unintended consequences, can now be explored through robots, time machines, and alien empires. To really feel what Hugo Gernsbach is doing, we have to put him back in his own sky full of futures. While he's editing amazing stories in the 1920s, Fritz Lang across the ocean is in Germany shooting Metropolis, this monumental dystopian sci-fi film about a stratified city in the year 2026, with robot doubles, skyscraper canyons, and workers fused literally to their machines. In Russia, in the town of Vitebsk, Mark Chagall, El Lizitsky, and their circle are trying to invent a Jewish modernism that can speak the language of abstraction and revolution without losing its soul, turning Hebrew letters, Passover songs, and village memories into bold geometric futures. So this is all happening at the same time, creatively. And hanging over all this is Albert Einstein, a Jewish physicist whose ideas, years before, about relativity, are literally rewriting time and space. Artists and writers feel that shockwave. Suddenly the universe is not a fixed clock, but a flexible, dynamic fabric. You can think of these as four different studios of the future. Einstein is in the lab, bending time and space with math and equations. The artists of Vitebsk are in the classroom and the street, bending Hebrew letters and village memories into radical new forms. Fritz Lang is on a soundstage in Berlin, bending light and shadow into a towering city of 2026. And Hugo Gernsbach is at his editorial desk, bending cheap pulp paper into a public laboratory where anyone with a dime can practice living in tomorrow. Different tools, different audiences, but the same underlying experiment. What happens if we start treating this world as a fixed thing and start treating it as something we can redesign? Inside Amazing Stories and its pulp cousins, you see an interesting paradox. On one side, some stories begin to imagine women as professionals and leaders, scientists, pilots, sometimes even political actors. They appear as doctors, lawyers, police figures, soldiers in future wars. This coincides with the waves of feminist struggle in the real world at the time, suffrage, higher education, and entry into male-dominated professions. On the other side, the same magazines are riddled with casual racism and sexism. Racial caricatures and eugenic assumptions show up as background wallpaper. Women are often sexualized, placed in peril, or treated as prizes, even when they also hold very modern roles. A classic example of the first Buck Rogers story, Armageddon 2419 AD, published in 1928 in Amazing Stories, it introduces Wilma Deering, who is both a capable adventurer and a romantic interest. She flies ships, carries weapons, and saves lives, but she is also framed through a male gaze that constantly undercuts her autonomy. This is the world of Gernsback is helping build, one where Pulp Fiction can simultaneously prototype women's agency, which wasn't happening at the time. Like, that's the thing we have to talk about here, and reinscribe the prejudices of its time. So it's interesting paradox there. If you're telling a story about Jewish futurism, this duality matters. Jewish creators are using these platforms to dream beyond their marginalization. But the same pages uncritically echo the racial and gender hierarchies of American modernity at the time. So Gernsback's obsession with how technology reshapes daily life is not limited to rockets and radios. It extends into the most intimate of domains. In 1933, he launches Sexology, a sex science, quote-unquote, magazine. Okay, but get this. It is the opposite of Playboy's glossy fantasy pages and foldouts. Think technical manual, charts, diagrams, like earnest Q&As about anatomy, relationships that read like instructions for stereos, and sexual health. It wants to be a clinical and educational a book and not something that's salacious. So early in the 1920s, he had already proposed systematic quasi-technological ways to match couples. He had wired tests, physiological measurements, early fantasies of mechanical matchmaking, decades before computer dating or swipeable apps. He is treating love as an engineering problem, an information flow that could, you know, in principle, be quantified and optimized. Okay. Really, really interesting. From a certain angle, this is, you know, incredibly weird. But from another, it's perfectly Gernsback, right, in his approach to things. So clinical. He is always asking, what happens when a new technology, whether radio, telephone, or some imagined love machine, quote unquote, insinuates itself into everyday human life and relations? How will it change the way we meet, commit, and care? Right? Great question. How has online dating, computer dating, if you remember that, and apps today, how has that changed the way we meet, commit, and care? Questions that are 100 years old here. So Gernsback loves gadgets, but he's also good at noticing their side effects. He writes about the telephone before it has fully saturated society, right? You have to remember the time that we're in, probing what it means to converse with disembodied voices, right? This is what they felt about telephones. You know, you couldn't see the person's face. He imagines devices like the telephot, an early fantasy of video calling, a screen in your home that lets you see the person you are talking to, long before Zoom meetings and FaceTime. For a generation of teenage readers, many of them immigrants, outsiders, and tinkerers, this was the first place they were told you are allowed to imagine systems bigger than your own life. You can be a kid working a terribly boring job by day, but then at night, you pick up Amazing Stories and live in a city of glass towers and monorails, argue with alien philosophers, or design a new communication device that works telepathically. The outer worlds is expanding too. By 1930, astronomers announced the discovery of Pluto, and suddenly, even on the edge of the solar system, is farther out than anyone thought. Inside the magazine, and outside, the map of what's possible is getting redrawn, and Gernsback is training you to ride that expansion with your imagination instead of being stunned by it. Okay, so back to the telephone real quick. The excitement is always paired with concern. If you can speak or even see each other without sharing physical space, what happens to the duty of showing up? Will people neglect friends and family because it's easier to call them than to go visit? Will distance relationships become normal? And will that be good or bad for us? These were the questions that he asked about just the regular telephone that people had in their home, not even a mobile phone that we have today. From where we stand, surrounded by smartphones with social media feeds on them and ambient connectivity 24/7, His questions land with a really eerie familiarity. We inhabit the world, he predicted, where our relationships with machines are so seamless that we mostly stop noticing the machines at all. They become ubiquitous. Gernsback doesn't have our vocabulary for algorithms or feeds, but he insists on a simple habit of mind. Every new medium changes what it feels like to be present with another human being. That's so interesting. If you don't think about that, you're letting someone else design your emotional life. That's incredibly true. So after the Great Depression ends, the World's Fair in Chicago and New York begin to showcase things like robots and streamlined cities and bizarre electrical devices that look like they've stepped straight off of the covers of Amazing Stories. This is a time where America's back on the rise and we need to look at the future. We began to, as what began as speculative diagrams becomes now national spectacle. The future climbs out of the pulps and onto the fairgrounds. As the decades roll on, science fiction tastes change. New editors and writers want complex characters, psychological nuance, political stakes. The so-called Golden Age and later the New Wave pushed the genre into philosophy, sociology, and inner space. Gernsback's own narrative form, the talkie, gadget-centered story built around lectures and diagrams, starts to feel creaky and a little old. He continues to push the same didactic, device-driven fiction, even as his readers' expectations evolve. Slowly, his magazines lose their central place in the field. Other editors, other venues start taking over the future. There is a quiet cosmic joke in kind of what happens next. Fandom and history began to call him the father of science fiction. Prestigious awards are named after him, like the Hugo Award. Writers fight each other for Hugos these days. But this is not how he wanted to be remembered. He saw himself primarily as an engineer and media technologist, as a pioneer of radio and electronics, and he wanted to be the father of wireless. With dozens of patents, influential technical magazines, a radio station, even early experiments with TV. The pulps in his self-image were almost a byproduct. So Hugo Gernsback dies in 1967, and he donates his body to science at Cornell's medical lab. There's no grave of his to visit. The honors he does receive have a strange kind of poetic symmetry. There's the major literary prize with his first name on it. And there's a crater on the moon also named the Gernsback crater. But ironically, I guess that crater is on the far side, the dark side of the moon, hidden from the, not visible from the earth. Kind of an invisible memorial for a man whose influence is everywhere and whose name is for most people nowhere. So where does that leave us if we want to talk about Jewish futurism? Gernsback rarely, if ever, puts clearly Jewish themes or characters into his own fiction. He doesn't write Torah in space or rabbis on Mars. Rabbis in his time do not line up to declare Amazing Stories is a Jewish work. They don't say it. They just don't. His Jewishness, though, plays out a little differently. As a Jewish immigrant in a suspicious America, he builds infrastructure in the cultural margins, magazines, fan networks, conceptual vocabularies. Those structures become the launch pad for later generations of Jewish creators who do bring Jewish questions, ethics, and symbols explicitly into speculative fiction. In that sense, he behaves like a modern Jewish technologist and artist. He doesn't always wave the flag. Instead, he helps invent the system through which identity, ethics, and imagination will later flow. So, across his life, Hugo Gernsback keeps offering the same proposition. Here is a new experience you get to immerse yourself into. New media, new machines, new forms of connection. You can walk away from them, or you can learn to use them. But you should never meet them unprepared. Very wise news. His pulps, his technical magazines, even his awkward sexology experiments all share a didactic core. They assume the future is shapeable by you, that technology is not a fate, but a field of choices. Learn how things work, he says. Think ahead about the consequences. Don't get left out of how technology will reshape your body, your love life, your community, and your sense of what is sacred. Today, in a world of climate emergency, AI hype, conspiracy memes, and collapsing trust in science, that stance feels strangely distant. We have the gadgets. We have more processing power in our pocket than Greensbach could have imagined. What we lack is a shared culture of futures literacy that is playful and critical at the same time. Maybe what we need now is not another charismatic tech CEO, but a new pulpy Greensbach. Somebody willing to build an unglamorous infrastructure for thinking together about what comes next. Someone who can restore a grounded faith in science, not as dogma, but as a communal practice of curiosity and argument back into our discourse. And until that person shows up, we have his example, a Jewish inventor publisher who believed that telling better stories about tomorrow could help us build a wiser, less frightened, and more responsible future starting today. Thank you for listening to the Jewish Futurism Lab. If this episode sparked something in for you, share it with a fellow tinkerer, a sci-fi fan, or that friend who still has a soldering iron in their closet. I'm Mike Wirth, and I will see you guys in the next episode. Bezrat Hashem.